Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Cynthia Griffith. I am the editor-in-chief of the Journal for Dermatology PAs. So if you're interested in writing or have an interesting case, please shoot it my way because we'd love to have it. Your bingo word for the afternoon is flip-flops. Your bingo word is flip-flops. Thanks for hanging with us this afternoon. We are going to have Miss Cynthia Trickett. Cynthia Trickett has been a PA since 1995. I was 9 years old when she graduated with her degree, the Bachelor's of Science in Physician Assistant Studies from the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas. She is adjunct faculty for physician assistant programs at both the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center as well as the University of North Texas. In her spare time, she enjoys travel, foreign movies, World War II history, and she works with the Ronald McDonald House of San Antonio. Please welcome my good friend and psoriasis guru, Mrs. Cynthia Trickett. And we will also need a volunteer for her talk. So if you're, this is like the magic show, people. So she's not gonna shoot lasers through your head, but if anybody would volunteer.
Can I have a hand? Volunteer. Somebody, it takes 2 seconds. 2 seconds, a hand. Oh my goodness, okay. Thank you, okay. The booby prize is after, no. Come on up. This is, you hear a lot of lip service about doing a psoriatic arthritis exam, but nobody shows you how to do a psoriatic arthritis exam. So rather than doing it in the middle of the talk, so you can take your notes, right? You're going to take copious
Thank
notes.
You.
I'm going to do it right now. So when I'm approaching a patient who I think has psoriatic arthritis, I would say, has anybody ever told you that you have arthritis?
No.
I would do the PEST questionnaire, in other words, and we're going to go through that as well, too. So I'm going to skip and be brief about it. When you wake up in the morning, any painful stiff joints when you wake up in the morning? Or with prolonged immobility? You're on a train ride, plane ride, long movie?
Not usually.
All right, so when you wake up in the morning, you can run, jump, dance, open a jar, play piano, run out of a burning building if you need to. No pain?
Maybe after 5 minutes I can do that.
After 5 minutes. Okay, so what's hurting you?
Sometimes it's stiff in the back or maybe sometimes the knee.
All right, so, and I would pay attention to those areas that he told me about, of course. Now, I'm going to start at the top and work my way down. Any pain when I press the neck here?
No.
All right, I'd have you lean forward. Any pain down the spine here? I know some people don't think about the spine as a joint, but it is a joint.
Not right now.
All right, perfect. Lean forward a little more. I'm going to touch the SI joints as well, too. Okay, go ahead and sit back up. Anything tender or painful when I do that? I'm going to touch the lateral epicondyles, squeeze the wrists, look at the fingers if I haven't already looked at the fingers, and I'm going to look at the fingernails. I'll also flip the hands because sometimes I'll look for psoriatic arthritis for psoriasis on the hands that I may not have seen in the exam. I'll also touch the medial condyle of the knee, the tibial tuberosity, medial malleolus of the ankle, and I'll touch the Achilles tendon area as well, too. The patient would have their shoes and socks off. I'd have you, can you stand up for me and face this way? Put your heels together, shoes and socks are off, and I'm looking at the Achilles tendon. All right, go ahead and have a seat. I'm also looking for swelling, right, in the fingers. I'm looking for dactylitis. Keep in mind that dactylitis may or may not be tender at that time. There's hot dactylitis, which it's hot, it's tender, difficult to bend. It could be cold dactylitis, meaning the dactylitis activity has calmed down. It's not in an acute phase, but it's still swollen. That's all. That's how quick. How long did that take? 2 minutes, 3 minutes? Okay, thank you so much, Andrew. Appreciate you.
I'm not doing a good enough job. I can see that from my sense.
Quick. Okay, so this is a psoriasis primer. We're going to talk about morphology, comorbidity. We touched a little bit on the psoriatic arthritis exam, current therapies, and what's on the horizon. Now, truth be told, I made this presentation back in, it was due September 1st, and certain therapies have been approved after that, so some of the language has changed. All right. Here's my conflicts. I'm a speaker and consultant. All right, here's our objectives, and I'm going to run through this very quickly because there's a lot of slides and I have a little bit of time. We're going to talk about epidemiology, we're going to talk about morphologies, comorbidities, and we're going to take a deeper dive into psoriatic arthritis. We'll review the current biologics approved for psoriasis vulgaris. We'll review the new topical therapies that are out that have, we've had a treatment gap when it comes to topical therapies. So we'll talk about the new topicals, and we'll also talk about some early conceptual phase studies. We'll review upcoming new oral medications. Actually, that's now approved, new oral medications, and of course, new biologics that are on the horizon. All right, just to, again, this is a primer, so a review of the epidemiology, and here's a hint, it hasn't changed much since 2003. Per the U.S. Census in 2020, estimated 7.55 million patients with psoriasis in the United States alone. As far as prevalence, women 3.2%, men 2.8%, age 3.0%, age 20 or above. And as far as the racial breakdown or heredity breakdown, Caucasians 3.6% prevalence, non-Hispanic, multiracial, 3.1%, Asian 2.5%, Hispanic 1.9%, and Black 1.5%. Sorry, I want to give some love to this side of the room too. Normally I stand at the podium, but everything's over here. All right, factoids. I love factoids because I'm a historical aficionado. Up to 20%, according to the National Psoriasis Foundation, have moderate to severe psoriasis. So that means the bulk have mild psoriasis, 80% with mild psoriasis. How did they come up with these numbers? They called patients who have a history and say, you know, how many hands of psoriasis have you had? So this was just based on total body surface area, not quality of life. Now that's incredibly important to me too, and then when I gauge psoriasis, I always include quality of life and not just body surface area. All right, but up to 30%, some say higher, up to 41% of patients will have psoriatic arthritis, so that's why it's important to screen every patient, every visit, every time, and you saw how quickly I was able to screen for psoriatic arthritis. All right, we know that it's genetics plus the environment. I have a lot of patients say, well, how did I get this? I tell them, you were born with a light switch for psoriasis, and something in your environment turned on the light switch, whether that was stress, trauma, medications, infection. The bigger bulk is we don't know what turned on your light switch for your psoriasis. And the next slide, we'll talk about the medications and the mnemonic that I came up with for the medications. The exact cause is unknown, but we're improving our understanding every single day, right? We're getting new therapies, a new concept of therapies every day. But there are two key mechanisms, and it involves the keratinocytes, hyperactivity and hyperproliferation. In the past, we just thought, before we knew it was an autoimmune disease, we said, oh, these are just the keratinocytes behaving badly. And this was my time. This is my time in dermatology. I've been in dermatology since 1998. The old school books used to say, oh, it's a keratinocyte problem, it's a skin problem, and only 5% of individuals will go on to develop psoriatic arthritis. Yeah, we know that's very different now. All right, what was wrong with the keratinocytes? We didn't know that the keratinocytes were getting a signal to behave badly, and that signal's coming from the immune system. All right, here's my mnemonic for medications that may worsen psoriasis. So if I have a patient who comes in with new psoriasis or they've had psoriasis and it got worse, these are some of the medications I'm reviewing for. Blabbings, B, beta blockers, especially the non-selective beta blockers. L, lithium. A, anti-malarials. B, other blood pressure medicines, including ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers. I've had a patient who, for years and years and years, I just couldn't get his psoriasis clear on his lower legs because his calcium channel blocker would create peripheral edema. Man, it was an uphill battle. And unfortunately, needed to be on this particular therapy. Biologics? Yeah, what was the... Really? We're using biologics to treat psoriasis. What are you talking about? I'm talking about other conditions. So for example, inflammatory bowel disease. We saw this, you know, more than a dozen times. Individuals on an IV therapy for inflammatory bowel disease, which is a biologic, they come in with new onset psoriasis, especially palmoplantar pustular psoriasis when they'd never had it before. So always be suspect of if they are on a biologic for another condition. Interferon, not seen so much anymore. We use different things to treat hepatitis. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, especially in the scalp of younger individuals. Gold salts, not seen much anymore. And the dreaded steroids. The Medrol dose pack, oh my gosh. If I can't tell you how many times a person went to an urgent care for a Medrol dose pack because of their sinus infection or they had contact dermatitis and now their psoriasis is worse, yeah. So steroids, especially Medrol dose pack. Now, often I'll have patients come in and I need to use a steroid. Oh, I'm going on a cruise and my joints are hurting a little bit and I want to have fun on my cruise. I'll give them oral steroids, but I give them lower doses and for a longer tapered. I don't do a Medrol dose pack. All right, so psoriasis and the immune system, what do we understand now? Every single psoriasis article you'll see, it's a common, chronic, non-infectious, autoimmune inflammatory disorder that's mediated by the immune system through a feedback loop. We have overproduction of inflammatory cytokines, of which some of them are interferon alpha and tumor necrosis factor alpha. These particular cytokines will activate the dermal dendritic cells, who will then secrete other inflammatory cytokines like IL-23. And in the presence of all of these inflammatory cytokines, naive T cells, so this is a T cell that was just born, oh, what am I going to be? Am I going to be a T helper 1, a T helper 2, a T helper 17? They preferentially differentiate into T helper 1 and T helper 17. And then the most important is T helper 17. So you have T cell differentiation preferentially in T helper 1 and T helper 17. And downstream, guess what? I love this. T helper 17 cells secrete IL-17. So the number correlates to the cytokine. And especially pathogenic cytokines are involved in psoriatic in the psoriatic milieu. All right, what are results of this immune system stimulation? The keratinocytes undergo like a precocious puberty. They normally take 30 days to grow and mature. Now they're doing it in 9 days. You can also have hyperproliferation, which represents the silvery scale. And if you peel off one of those scales, you get pinpoint bleeding, which is called Auschwitz sign. So I've had some patients come in and I'm like, is this PR or is this guttate psoriasis? I'll take my ruler and I'll scrape off a little bit of the cell. It's more likely to bleed if it's psoriasis. All right, so erythema represents the elongation of ridges in the dermis and engorgement of the blood vessels. All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk about morphologies. Plaque psoriasis we're very familiar with, guttate psoriasis, and when I see a patient come in with guttate psoriasis, my first question is, have you recently had a strep infection or a sore throat that you may not have been diagnosed with a strep infection? And if the answer is, well, yeah, I've had a strep infection. Were you treated? No, I wasn't treated. It just went away. Whoa, I need to prevent glomerulonephritis, so I'm going to treat the patient for a strep infection. I'm also going to check their ASO titer. All right, so if a person ends up having guttate psoriasis maybe one or more times after strep infections, how often are those patients likely to convert to psoriasis vulgaris? About a third of the time. Pustular psoriasis milieu can include GPP, which is, we've got some exciting therapy now for that. We used to just, oh my gosh, what are we going to use? Shoot a dart against the wall and hopefully one of them will work. We've got a lot more specific therapy now. GPP, palmoplantar pustular psoriasis, which has been the bane of our psoriasis existence. It's the thing that's starting to give me gray hair, right? Because those patients are so difficult to treat. But we're seeing some hope now. Acrodermatitis of Hallopo, it is a subtype of psoriasis, and we'll show you a good picture of that. Inverse psoriasis, which is terribly important to patients, can be very painful. I had a young girl tell me, every time I sit down, it feels like I'm getting a paper cut in my G-cleft. She didn't use that word, of course, but paper cut in my G-cleft. It is a major quality of life issue for patients with inverse psoriasis. And of course, erythrodermic psoriasis. In my time, I've probably seen about 40 cases of erythrodermic psoriasis. Here's pictures. You've seen this all before. So plaque psoriasis, the well-circumscribed silvery scale, usually thick. You peel off one of those scales, you'll have pinpoint bleeding. Inverse psoriasis can look very beefy, red, and shiny, often misdiagnosed in primary care settings as a candidiasis. And sometimes we can induce a candidiasis, or it can be induced if steroids are used inappropriately in these particular areas. Erythrodermic psoriasis, red man syndrome, erythroderma meaning red skin. Normally I don't see it so scaly as this, but we're talking about, by definition, about 90% of the body is covered with psoriasis. It is a medical emergency, needs treatment immediately. Pustular psoriasis, this particular picture is an example of acrodermatitis of Hallopo, and guttate psoriasis. Guttate comes from the Roman word meaning drop-like psoriasis. Okay. Not Roman word, Greek, excuse me. All right, here's an example of palmoplantar pustular psoriasis. Often you can see why, misdiagnosed as an infection in the non-dermatology providers. These pustules are sterile and consist mostly of white blood cells and neutrophils. You'll see some dry vesicles as well, too. This is incredibly difficult to treat. Here's palmoplantar psoriasis, not pustular psoriasis. So when you're looking at studies, most of the time they're looking at palmoplantar psoriasis, not palmoplantar pustular psoriasis. So these patients will often have thick scale. It can be, they'll try and scrape it off, or they'll go to and get their feet, they get the feet did, and they'll try and scrape the scale off, and unfortunately that makes it worse. And these patients will often have very painful fissures. All right, what about nail psoriasis? Here's a couple great pictures of nail psoriasis. Starting on the left, you see leukonychia, you see pits, and you see onycholysis, often mistaken for onychomycosis, of course. And in the middle, you see really good examples of oil drop sign for nail psoriasis. And then, of course, this last person has psoriasis not only on the fingers and pericuticular, and they've got onychodystrophy throughout. Here's acrodermatitis of Hallopo, which is a pustular psoriasis that is confined to the tips of the fingers, tips of the toes, and often the nail is involved. And the nail dystrophy can be quite severe. Here is a GPP, or generalized pustular psoriasis. If I have a patient come in with this, the first thing I'm going to look at is their medication list. Terbinafine can cause something called AGEP, which is not psoriasis, which is acute generalized exanthematous pustulosis, so I'm going to make sure it's not AGEP, but I'm also going to look at any medications that which may have worsened their psoriasis. Where do I see this often? The dreaded Midrol dose pack, yes. All right, so what about skin of color? Yeah, psoriasis can look similar, but there are differences, especially when we're talking about erythema. The erythema can be a little more violaceous, and it can be a little more hidden or difficult to distinguish and be underappreciated. There's a lot more risk of hyper or hypopigmentation in individuals who have psoriasis, no matter where it is on their body. There is a distinct subgroup of individuals, especially in the Asian population, who will have this kind of overlap of psoriasis eczema overact. The eczema looks like psoriasis, or their psoriasis looks like eczema. So sometimes you just have to go, all right, let me look at your history. Let me look at you from head to toe. Do you have any nail changes that look like psoriasis? Do you have any psoriasis in the G cleft? Because I often don't see eczema in the G cleft. And if all things are being equal, sometimes you just have to choose one path and start down one path, and if they don't get better, you may have to choose another. If I'm leaning more toward the psoriasis picture, I'm usually picking, this is just me, I'm picking an IL-17. There's a higher degree of scalp involvement in individuals with skin of color, and unfortunately, skin of color individuals are still underrepresented in our trials. When you look at the trials across the board, across the United States, it's Caucasian individuals over 40 and usually male. All right, here's an example of psoriasis in skin of color. You can see the thick, prominent scale on the scalp, and it's encroaching down on the forehead. I bet that their ears and behind the ears are involved as well, too. Here's another example where you can really, it's difficult to appreciate the erythema. Yes, you see a ring of erythema on the one by the wist, but it's not as beefy wet or red or widespread as we see in individuals who are not skin of color. Here's an example of the quote-unquote psoriasis eczema overlap in individuals of Asian descent. So look at this elbow. So you see some spots that really look like psoriasis, but the rest of the forearm looks a little bit more like eczema. So again, use all your clues, look at them from head to toe, look in the genital area, ask about the genital area, look in the genital area, and look at the nails as well, too. All right, let's talk about comorbidities. This has been shoved down our throat, right? But it's very important to know that, you know, psoriasis confers a 25% relative risk of cardiovascular disease. This is independent of smoking, independent of hyperlipidemia, independent of obesity. So yeah, psoriasis is as bad for you as a risk for cardiovascular disease as smoking. All right, so I remember when I was in PA school, what are the things that we have to ask about? Somebody's coming in for a heart attack, and I'm going to ask you questions. Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? Are you obese? Do you smoke, et cetera? We didn't ask about psoriasis. Now they should be asking about psoriasis. Okay, so I say psoriasis is a multiplier. So for all of these particular comorbidities, independent of psoriasis, okay, they occur at their normal risk levels. But if you add psoriasis, it ratchets up the risk of these conditions. So we talked about cardiovascular disease, including MIs, AAA, stroke, or cardiovascular disease. And in fact, in 2012, the New England Journal of Medicine was reporting an article that, hey, individuals who are treated with methotrexate are having less pro-atherogenic lipids. So there's something involved with psoriasis and cardiovascular disease. Of course, psoriatic arthritis, immune-mediated diseases like autoimmune thyroid disease or inflammatory bowel disease. And if there's one thing that you take home from this lecture today, hopefully you can take more home, but if you have psoriatic arthritis, please screen for inflammatory bowel disease. Those two are closely related. Metabolic syndrome, including hypertension, dyslipidemia, obesity, and insulin resistance. We see that especially with elevated levels of TNF and IL-23. Psychiatric comorbidities, including anxiety and depression, among others, but these are the most common. And what about the other category? We know that lymphoma is at higher risk for individuals who have psoriasis, so is uveitis, especially with psoriatic arthritis. Fatigue, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, reduced EGFR or estimated GFR, so kidney disease, and COPD. All right, let's do a little deeper dive into psoriatic arthritis. We know that you heard me ask the questions, pain, swelling, stiffness in your joints. Now keep in mind, if you just ask, hey, do you have any pain in your joints? They may miss the ligament or tendon insertion sites. So a lot of people have a disconnect between, oh, I didn't know my neck was a joint. I thought my neck was my neck. No, your neck is multiple joints. So is your mid-back, your low back. Yeah, where your toes connect to your feet. That's a joint as well, too. So don't just ask about joints. Also ask about any pain, stiffness, swelling, discomfort when you wake up in the morning. If yes, okay, how long does it last? If that's a minute or two, that's probably positional. But if it lasts for 30 minutes to an hour, or if that happens with prolonged immobility, your risk of psoriatic arthritis, our flag should be going up in our head going, maybe this is psoriatic arthritis. Fatigue. I had a patient 2 weeks ago. She was referred to me by somebody else in our practice. She came in for injections of her toe for psoriatic arthritis, for psoriasis of her toenail. And she was wearing flip-flops, and I was like, wow, her right toe is so much bigger than her left toe, at least I think so. Take off your shoes. And I'm like, whoa, she had a big old fat toe. Her scalp was involved. And she had nail psoriasis on her fingernail, and she was concerned about this. I started asking the appropriate questions. Yes, 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 I think you have psoriatic arthritis. Let's talk a little bit more. And I asked about fatigue. Said, would you say that you're more fatigued than usual? She burst into tears, and I thought, did I just say a bad word? What did I just say? Fatigue? Is that what's making you cry? I'm sorry, what happened? She said, I'm a 38-year-old mother of four, and I shouldn't be this tired. My husband wants to know why I'm napping all the time, and he has to take care of the kids. So, I mean, it was incredible. What was most distressing to her that made her cry was fatigue, not how her nail looked. If it's undetected, the patient can have permanent bony changes, erosive bony changes. They can have joint space narrowing. And, of course, that all leads to pain and disability for patients. High morbidity there. Prevalence is highest in Caucasian individuals. It's often underdiagnosed. There's a too long of a time between detection and diagnosis. Associated scalp nail findings, perhaps genital psoriasis. So again, if I'm seeing scalp findings, nail findings, or it's in their genital area, if I haven't already, and I usually already have, but I haven't already, I'm again asking about joints. Comorbidities most commonly associated with psoriatic arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease. So again, that's a factoid. It is absolutely true, 40% higher risk of inflammatory bowel disease when you have psoriatic arthritis. And of course, you're going to ask about their eyes too, right? Uveitis is higher in individuals who have psoriatic arthritis. The genetic marker that's most common in individuals with psoriatic arthritis is HLA-B27, which of course is also found in ankylosing spondylitis. All right, psoriatic arthritis continued. It's highly heritable. In fact, 40% of the time, the patient will say, yeah, I have a family member who's had psoriasis, or I have a family member who's been told that they have arthritis, inflammatory arthritis. I'm not sure what it is. We've never been able to figure out if it's rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis, but most of the time, it's psoriatic arthritis. Individuals will usually present with skin disease before joint disease, and that's usually about 80% of the time, the bulk of the time. What's the time frame? About 5 to 10 years before individuals will develop joint disease. But don't let that fool you, because there are patients who will develop skin and joint disease at the same time, and there are individuals who will develop joint disease before their skin disease. Now, usually we're not seeing them. They're usually in the rheumatology office. But again, I must impress upon you, every patient, every visit, every time, screen their joints. You saw how quickly and how easily that was. Heterogeneous, five major types. You can have dip predominant, and of course, if their dips are involved and inflamed, nearly 100% of the time they're gonna have nail psoriasis. You can have asymmetric oligoarticular, and sometimes that can be confused with pseudo-gout. So if I have a patient who has psoriasis and I ask him about joint pain, oh yeah, I have a history of gout, I probe that a little further. Symmetric polyarthritis, spondylitis, and arthritis mutilans. I will say that in this day and age, with the therapies that we have for psoriatic arthritis, the incidence of arthritis mutilans should be approaching nearly nil. Okay. Most of the time we think, oh, well, if it's inflammatory, the ESR or CRP should be elevated. That only happens in 10% of the time. So don't think that, well, I can't get them into the rheumatologist for 6 months. Let me just do an a CRP or an ESR, and it's not elevated. The risk isn't there. That is not true. Don't get fooled into that. Soft tissue swelling often precedes osseous findings. So what are we saying here? By the time you have osseous findings, the cat's already out of the bag. We need to intervene sooner. So if you see swelling, yes, they may already have some osseous findings, but if it's new, hopefully we can interdict and intervene before the patient does have x-ray findings. Now, if a patient has a swollen finger or toe and there's no x-ray findings, that's where the rheumatologist may use ultrasound or MRI. One more time, if a person has psoriatic arthritis, ask about inflammatory bowel disease. There is an increased financial burden for patients who have psoriatic arthritis, not only to the patient themselves, but also to the healthcare system. There's a lot of morbidity and a lot of disability associated with that. Increased risk of developing psoriatic arthritis. We already talked about scalp, nails, and genital findings, but if a patient has psoriasis and they're obese, more likely to develop psoriatic arthritis, if they have early age of onset, if they have higher body surface area, if they smoke, if they have a family history, if they drink alcohol, and if they already have a history of uveitis. So again, inflammatory bowel disease, uveitis, highly associated with psoriatic arthritis. All right, here's the PEST questionnaire. And how many of you guys have Emma? Show of hands. Emma. It's in your Emma, so make your medical assistants ask that question before you ask these questions in the PEST questionnaire. If you just go to, there's an area where you can use your extra findings, just do PEST, and it's in there. Your medical assistant can ask that. But of course, if my medical assistant forgets to ask, once I start asking the questions, I kind of give a look, and like, okay, are you getting that? So they're going to the PEST questionnaire. Have you had swollen joints or joints? Has a provider ever told you that you have arthritis? Do your fingernails or toenails have holes or pits? And have you ever had a finger or toe that was swollen or painful for no reason? I understand if you drop a frozen turkey on your toe, it should be painful and swollen. Okay, I'm talking about no trauma. Have you had a swollen finger or toe? Have you had pain in your heel, or has anybody ever told you that you have plantar fasciitis? And then, of course, on the questionnaire itself, the patient can check the marks. Now, if we're doing it in EMR, we're getting away with paper, right? But if you don't have it in your EMR, or if you want them to do something while they're waiting for you to come in the room, the reason why I like the paper is because it often tells the patient, think about your neck, think about your back, think about your heels, think about your toes, where patients don't often associate that with a joint. And this is just asking about pain anywhere. All right. There are some things that the PEST questionnaire can miss, which is why there's a new questionnaire. It hasn't been validated yet, but the rheumatologist and GI doctors have come up with a new questionnaire. We're not using it again yet. It's called the detail questionnaire. And the idea that for the detail questionnaire is to improve the incidence of finding spondyloarthropathies that are associated with other inflammatory diseases like inflammatory bowel disease. So using this particular questionnaire improves the time to diagnosing spondyloarthropathies. All right, this is early identification of axial spondyloarthropathy, and again, only 10% had an elevated ESR or CRP, and we're waiting a validation for psoriatic arthritis. This was presented at the GRAPPA session in, I'm gonna see if I can go back, no, I can't go back, in 2022. All right. Here's some of the questions I'm not allowed to have. Holding it tight to their chest. They wouldn't share the questionnaire with me, but here's the gist of the questions. Number one, do you have inflammatory back pain at night? Do you have a presence of Achilles enthesitis? Do you have back pain longer than 3 months? Back pain with inflammatory features? Do you have peripheral synovitis or inflammation of the synovium? Do you have a history of dactylitis? So if a patient answers yes to three or more of these questions, about 80% of the time they have SPA, which is a spondyloarthropathy. And a lot of times you will not have radiographic findings. By the time you have radiographic findings, the cat is already out of the bag. All right, the difference between psoriatic arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid factor can sometimes be positive, and in fact, in the early days when we were screening everybody for rheumatoid factor, about 15% of the time they had positive, but they didn't have rheumatoid arthritis. They had psoriatic arthritis. So it may or may not be positive. The better test is an anti-CCP. So it is negative in psoriatic arthritis. It's positive in rheumatoid arthritis. So there's dichotomous. Yes, you have it, or no, you don't. No rheumatoid nodules in individuals who have psoriatic arthritis. You can have rheumatoid nodules in rheumatoid arthritis. Dactylitis, sausage digit, and psoriatic arthritis? Yes, not with rheumatoid arthritis. Nail changes, psoriasis nail changes? Yes, with psoriatic arthritis, not with rheumatoid arthritis. And what about osteoporosis? Very little osteoporosis, either juxtapositional to an inflamed joint, where it's more common in individuals with rheumatoid arthritis. All right, so I did a little probative, like, okay, I know that in the presence of psoriasis, if a person has dactylitis, it is psoriatic arthritis until proven otherwise. Well, what are some of the other causes of dactylitis? Sickle cell disease, tuberculosis, sarcoidosis, infections like syphilis, staph, strep, or gonorrhea. And then that's kind of a joke in our clinic. Oh, they have a swollen dome. Is it gonorrhea? We ask, you know, but that just kind of heightens our awareness that it may not always be psoriatic arthritis. Spondyloarthropathies. Yes, remember we talked about inflammatory bowel disease and psoriatic arthritis? Guess who else can have a spondyloarthropathy? HS. So you should be asking about joint symptoms in individuals with HS as well, too. Reactive arthritis, in my day it was called Reiter syndrome, right? But other inflammatory arthritis. But again, rheumatoid arthritis does not have dactylitis. Here's an example of an individual with a sausage finger, the middle finger, but I can also see a little bit of erythema and swelling there at the dip on the fifth finger. I would love to see what the nails look like, so I would probably remove that person's nail polish with some acetone. Here's a person who's kind of toe up from the floor up. You would not miss this, right? This person has nail changes associated with psoriasis, they have dip involvement, they have pericuticular psoriasis, and they also have dactylitis, the left fourth finger, the middle joint, and yeah, I see it also on the third joint of the left hand, the dip, and I see it in the dip on the fourth finger as well too. This is an extreme case, right? You would not miss that, but this is just an example of, yeah, here it is right in your face, you can't miss that. All right, enthesitis, right? This is where we're looking at tendon insertion sites or ligament insertion sites. Probably the one of the more common is the Achilles tendon, which is why it's important to remove the shoes and socks and look. And also you're looking for dactylitis in a toe. Again, cold dactylitis may not be symptomatic in a toe, and they may not have put those things together. All right, we already had our volunteer. Let's move, shift gears. We're looking at the current biologics for plaque psoriasis. So the TNF category is pretty full, etanercept, adalimumab, infliximab, which is an infusion, and certolizumab. IL-1223 class, only one, ustekinumab. IL-17, secukinumab, ixekizumab, and brodalumab. The little star means that it's not approved for psoriatic arthritis in the United States. And what about the IL-23 space? Guselkumab, tildrakizumab, and risankizumab. What about those that are only approved for psoriatic arthritis, but not for skin disease? Golimumab in the TNF space. And of course, there's this medication called abatacept, which is kind of a small molecule DMARD biologic. It kind of is its own little hybrid kind of disease medication. We're not using it, right? That's the rheumatologists who are using it. What about oral DMARDs for psoriasis, not including abatacept? Methotrexate, sulfasalazine, 6-thioguanine. A lot of these are, you know, very passe. Cyclosporin, acitretin, mycophenolate mofetil, and hydroxyurea. Apremilast, we know it has been approved. There's a new one that's been approved for psoriasis, deucravacitinib, which is a TYK2 selective Janus kinase inhibitor. What about the DMARDs that are approved for psoriatic arthritis? Very similar, methotrexate, sulfasalazine, leflutamide, cyclosporin, tacrolimus, oral tacrolimus, not topical, apremilast, and abatacept. Okay. There has been a gap in topical treatments for so long, right? Everybody got topical steroids, then they started adding, oh, a little bit of vitamin D here, a little bit of retinoid here, but we really weren't getting anything new for so long. And there was, you know, a lot of dissatisfaction with therapy. So topicals are prescribed whether you have mild, moderate, or severe psoriasis, right? And those are according to the recommendations of the National Psoriasis Foundation and the AAD, no matter what. Mild, moderate, severe, give them a topical. And when it says more than 90% of the time, in my practice, that's closer to 100% of the time. It's rare that I don't prescribe a topical. Major treatment gap, including considering that topical steroids and combination therapy has been the mainstay. Patients were not happy. We weren't happy. Why? Because of safety, tolerability, efficacy, side effects, tachyphylaxis, compliance, and especially efficacy. Our patients were, you know, would get very confused about very difficult treatment regimens. Oh, you can't use this steroid. Don't use this steroid on the face, groin, axilla, but use this one in your scalp. Use this one in your groin. And after 2 weeks, we're going to switch you to this as you taper paper off. It got very confusing. And in fact, I would give these calendars with a legend that would say SS steroids, SS steroids. I mean, it was complicated. All right. Compared to topical corticosteroids and topical calcineurin inhibitors, we were looking for something that was better, more strong when it comes to anti-inflammatory effects, anti-proliferative effects, easier to use, less complicated, and better safety, especially with long-term use. How many times have we had patients inappropriately prescribed Lotrizone for what was considered a tinea infection in the groin, and they end up with stria from here to here because they've used Lotrizone off and on for years, right? Not appropriate anymore. Okay, so this is no order of importance, but the first one that I put in my slides was Vtama, which is brought to you by Dermavant. This is tapinarof. It is novel, first in class, non-steroidal, small molecule. It is gluten-free. Yeah, I've had patients ask that. And what is that every day? Everybody's asking about gluten-free. Is that coffee gluten-free? Really? Okay, gluten-free. Okay, I got it. It's gluten-free. Cream, used once a day. No restrictions on where to use it or how long to use it. No black box warnings. This one is 18 and up. There are no contraindications or precautions. This is novel. We haven't had anything like this, either oral or topical. No, this is topical, novel. It is an AHR agonist. What do you mean? In English, please? Anybody get the reference? In English, please? The Usual Suspects, the movie? Usual Suspects? Anyway, okay. In English, what does that mean if it's an AHR receptor agonist? It binds to and upregulates these particular receptors. So what does AHR do? It's a protein, an intracellular protein that's involved in gene transcription. So in the psoriasis space, this role relates to T helper 17 differentiation and production of IL-17 and IL-22. So what happens when you activate the receptor? If you activate it, you get antioxidant activity. We know oxidative species will inflame psoriasis more. And you also have upregulation of filaggrin, loricrin, and involucrin. Now, when we think about those particular molecules, we often think of atopic dermatitis and the skin barrier. But skin barrier is important in psoriasis as well, too. It's important in rosacea as well, too. It's not just limited to atopic dermatitis. All right, what happens when you activate the receptor? Other things get downregulated, like T helper 17 cells, Th2 cytokines, and T helper 2 cell development. All right, so that's exactly what I said. What happens when you upregulate this and downregulate that? You get decreased inflammation in the plaques, decreased oxidative stress, decreased inflammation. Especially, we talked about some of the other, you know, T helper 2 and T helper 17, but you also get reduction of IL-4 and IL-5, which we're thinking about, wait, I thought that's with atopic dermatitis, but that also happens here. Now, am I telling you to use it for atopic dermatitis? No, because that would be considered off-label, but it is provocative when we hear that it also decreases IL-4 and IL-5. Increased normalization of the skin barrier when we talked about filaggrin, et cetera. All right, 82% of patients in the studies had moderate psoriasis. So we're using topical for moderate psoriasis, and that wasn't the only patients, right? There were some patients who were considered severe. Total body surface area range was between 3 and 20%. Now, I don't know about you, when I'm approaching 5 or above, I'm thinking biologic, right? So some of these patients had a lot of psoriasis. 20% is a lot of psoriasis. This is a once daily application. Again, no restriction on where it was being used. This was Vtama versus vehicle, over 1,000 patients. The pivotal trials are Soaring 1 and 2. Primary endpoint, how many patients are clear or almost clear, which is a 0 or 1, by week 12, with at least a 2-grade improvement. All right, what are the results? 36% versus 6% placebo in Soaring 1, and in Soaring 2, that was 40% versus 6%. Again, the primary endpoint, how many patients were clear or almost clear by week 12. What about PASI scores? Those were secondary endpoints that they were looking at. Really? PASI 75 with a topical? Oh, interesting. All right. PASI 75. How many patients got to PASI 75? 36% versus 10.2 in the vehicle group. What about PASI 90? 19% versus 2%. And in Soaring 2, the numbers were 48% versus 7% for PASI 75 and 21% versus 3% for PASI 90. Adverse reactions. Folliculitis was seen about 20% of the time. Now I'm going to, you know, just say it. I've used it. I haven't seen any folliculitis. I'm on the look for it. I haven't seen any. But in the clinical trials, yep, it was reported up to 20%. So you should be on the lookout for it as well. Pharyngitis, 11%. Contact dermatitis, 7%. 4% headache, 3% pruritus, and 2% flu. No evidence of tachyphylaxis, yay, which is what we see with steroids, right? No new adverse events and no contraindications in the label. No lab value discrepancies versus placebo. In fact, in the PK studies, they said, well, how much of this medicine is absorbed? Picograms, that's N to the 12th, picograms. Early statistical separation was seen as early as week 4, so you didn't have to wait until week 12. Almost 41% of patients in the open label extension or the long-term extension trial got to PGA 0. And keep in mind that some of these patients had up to 20% of their body surface area. Okay. 52% of patients who had at least a PGA of at least 2 got to a PGA of 0 or 1. So not just the zeros, how about 0 or 1 in the open label extension or the long-term extension? More than half. Following, here's the interesting kicker right here. Following 12 weeks of therapy, 73% of patients got to a PGA of 0. And then we're told to stop VTAMA and don't use it again until you get to a PGA of at least 2. How many got to a PGA two, or how long did it take for patients to get to a PGA to at least 2? 4 months. So there's new language here with our topical therapies, remittive therapy. We could never see that with topical steroids or combination therapies. As soon as patient stops, within 2 to 4 weeks, they're flaring back up again. All right, so continued efficacy while on treatment and lasting or remittive effects, even when off treatment. Interesting concept there. All right. New topicals for psoriasis, this is ZORYVE, which is brought to you by Arcutis, which is roflumilast, a topical PDE4 inhibitor. All right, so before you go, wait a second, we've already heard about PDE4 inhibitor. There's an oral one, there's a previous topical one that we've already used. This is a different molecule, roflumilast. All right, topical PDE4 cream, non-steroidal, use once daily, 12 and up, and yes, it's gluten-free too. All right, so why is this language in the label about, hey, exposure, if you give roflumilast, you may have difficulty with some other medications, and those are listed in the star. Clarithromycin, erythromycin, diltiazem, I'm not gonna read them all to you. And what about this oral contraceptive? It's not even available in the United States, but this is Minulet. All right, where did that language come from? It came from the oral roflumilast studies. Oral roflumilast is used for COPD. So unfortunately, the FDA said, well, we've already seen it with oral roflumilast, so it needs to be in your label too. Okay, gotcha. All right, contraindications, moderate to severe liver impairment. This is not NASH. We see NASH all the time with our patients who have psoriasis. This is not NASH. This is way beyond NASH. And again, this is also inherited from the oral roflumilast studies. What about if we're just looking at topical? What are the adverse reactions? Diarrhea, about 3.1%. Headache, 2.4%. Insomnia, 1.4%. Nausea, 1.2%. Application site pain, 1%. And this is important because there were a lot of patients who had intertriginous or inverse psoriasis in the study, and we'll look at that. We'll probe that a little more. Upper respiratory tract infection, 1%, and UTI, 1%. There were 881 patients with mild to severe plaque psoriasis, so from mild to severe, but the bulk were moderate. It ranged from the body surface area, 2 to 20%. In fact, 76% had moderate disease, were considered an IGA score of 3, and 8% severe. Again, most of the time we're thinking biologic for these particular patients. All right, 20% of patients had intertriginous psoriasis, so their IGA, intertriginous IGA score, investigator's global assessment score, was at least a two in 20% of individuals. What about worst itch? How many patients had a worst itch numeric rating scale of at least 4? That was 77%. So in the old books, we used to say the difference between eczema and psoriasis is that eczema itches and psoriasis doesn't. Don't you believe it? We know that's different. We absolutely know that psoriasis can itch. And it's, in fact, if my patient comes back and they're totally clear and they're still itching, they ain't happy. So I need to do something about their itch. And of course, if they itch and scratch, their psoriasis is going to get worse because of kebnerization, which is why scalps are so difficult to treat because patients will scratch and pick. All right, let's go back to ZORYVE. It's applied once daily for 8 weeks. Primary endpoint is how many patients are clear or almost clear with at least a 2-grade improvement. Secondary endpoints, we were looking at the inverse areas. How many patients were considered an IIGA success, and I'll tell you what that means in just a second, by week 8, and how many got improvement of their worst itch score of at least 4 points at week 2, at week 4, and then week 8. The pivotal studies, Dermis 1 and 2, with this was roflumilast cream versus vehicle, not placebo versus vehicle. And if you haven't had a chance to feel the vehicle, pretty interesting a molecule there. Dermis 1, how many patients got to clear or almost clear and had a 2-grade improvement? 41.5% versus 5.8%. Clear or almost clear? 41.5%. Dermis 2, 36.7% versus 7.1%. So a wide separation between placebo and responders. All right, how many patients had an inverse or intertriginous psoriasis IGA score of at least 2 at baseline? 22% in Dermis 1 and 19% in Dermis 2. To be considered IIGA success, you had to have a score of clear or almost clear with at least a 2-grade improvement by week 8. These numbers are pretty provocative. How many patients were clear or almost clear by week 8 in the intertriginous or inverse psoriasis? 71.5%. And remember, 1% complained of irritation with topical application versus 13.8% in Dermis 1. And those numbers were 67.5% responders in Dermis 2 versus 17.4%. All right, what about itch? Looking at week 2, week 4, and week 8, how many patients got at least a 4-grade improvement of their worst itch score? By week 2, there's a separation between placebo and roflumilast in both studies, and that goes on to further separate by week 8. So you're looking at almost 70% in Dermis 1 versus less than 30%, closer to 20% in the vehicle group. What about Dermis 2? Those numbers are very similar, about 70% and 30%, not exact. All right, switching gears. New DMARD. This is not upcoming. It has been approved. So tick 2. Deucravacitinib, brought to you by Bristol-Myers Squibb. This is an oral JAK, which is selective. Why is that term important? Because of the safety labeling that the FDA decided not to give. So tick 2. All right, so it's an oral JAK, which is selective for the TYK2 pathway. As you know, the Janus kinase inhibitor or the Janus kinase JAK-STAC pathway has a pairing of the JAKs, right? So how did they get that name? The Roman god of before and after was named Janus. It was the two-faced god, right? That's how they got that term, Janus kinase. So just a little bit of useless cocktail trivia for you. All right, an allosteric mechanism, which means it binds to the regulatory or indirect domain where JAK1 and JAK3 bind, so now they can't bind. It changes shape, and ATP cannot bind as well, and I'll show you that in a picture. There are current black box issues with the other oral JAK inhibitors, including the topical JAK, whether that's fair or not. Some of that language was inherited from the oral surveillance study. So how many are familiar with the oral surveillance study? Oral surveillance study. Okay, yeah, the FDA said, hey, Pfizer, you have tofacitinib, and we're worried about safety. We're worried about MACE events, and we're worried about cancer in your drug in patients who have rheumatoid arthritis, not psoriatic arthritis, not psoriasis, not atopic dermatitis, so different disease, different drug, and these are patients who were over 50, also on methotrexate, and already had evidence of at least one risk factor for cardiovascular disease. So, you know, I have a lot of feelings about that. I think it was unfairly labeled, but it is what it is. The data is what it is, but you need to understand the oral surveillance study because that's where this safety language came from. Different disease, different drug, different kind of patient. All right, so TYK2 mechanism of selectivity showing less events of MACE events, clots, and cancer that we've already seen in the others that got labeled, that safety label. And guess what? We'll see if the FDA enforces the black box warnings. They didn't. So selectivity does have a lot to do with that. Here's a picture of the selectivity. So in the interest of time, I'm going to speed through this. So deucravacitinib is the light blue triangle and the two kind of guitar pick looking let's see if I can point. Am I pointing? All right, here we go. So this is deucravacitinib. Here is the JAK issue. All right. Deucravacitinib, here's JAK right here. So this binds to the indirect site, and it changes the size and shape of the, it changes just the shape, excuse me, the shape of the molecule. Now ATP can't bind here and activate the STAT pathway. Right there. Okay, POETIC 1 and POETIC 2 were the pivotal trials for deucravacitinib versus placebo. Primary endpoint was how many patients got to PASI 75 and a PGA score of 0-1 by week 16. So in POETIC 1, how many patients got to PASI 75 by week 16? 58% versus 12% in placebo. What about POETIC 2? 53% versus 9%. How many patients were clear or almost clear? 53% versus 7% in POETIC 1. And in POETIC 2, that was 50% versus 8%. What about PASI 90? These were some secondary endpoints that we looked at. How many patients got to PASI 90 by 52 weeks? 44% of individuals, nearing 50%. PASI 100, about 20% of individuals. The safety issues associated with deucravacitinib, because, you know, right, when we hear about a new molecule and it's also in the JAK-STAT mechanism, we safety, our ears perk up, and we go, okay, what's going on with safety there? URI, 5% versus 9.1%. So 5% was in the 0 to 16 week, 9% was at the 52 week marker. What about nasopharyngitis? 9% at the 0 to 6 week marker versus 16.8% at the 52 week. Headache, 4.5 and 5.9 respectively. GI, diarrhea, 1.4% nausea versus 5.1% at the 52 week. And yes, we've got 2-year data, safety data, that we're still collecting. All right, they did a head-to-head. What about deucravacitinib versus apremilast? At PASI 75 at week 16, deucravacitinib had 58% of individuals who got to PASI 75 versus 35% in the apremilast group. What about PASI 90 at week 24? Those numbers were 69% versus 38%. Okay, shifting gears. This is one that hasn't been approved yet. This is bimekizumab from UCB. It is a monoclonal IgG1 antibody, which inhibits IL-17 A and F, not A through F, like an IL-17 that's already on the market. 435 patients were dosed every 4 weeks, and we wanted to see how many patients got to PASI 90. 91% at week 16 versus 1% placebo. Let me repeat that one more time. 91% of patients got to PASI 90 at week 16, every 4-week dosing, versus 1% in the placebo group. Yeah, high levels of response that's durable over 56 weeks. What about safety? Nasopharyngitis, oral candidiasis, upper respiratory tract infection, low incidence of inflammatory bowel disease, and adjudicated significant or serious infection in MACE were low, less than 1%. All right, what about Spivigo? This is kind of interesting. This is an IL-36 mechanism of action. This is spizolimab, which was brought to you by BI, or Boehringer Ingelheim. 53 patients, 35 in the treatment group, 18 in the placebo group, were given a 900 milligram infusion on day zero. And if they weren't responding by day 8, they were allowed to have another infusion. So how many patients got clear by after their first week? 54%. Like I said, in the past, when it came to GPP or generalized pustular psoriasis, we were like, okay, am I going to use cyclosporin? Am I going to use Remicade? Am I going to add methotrexate? What am I going to do for this particular patient? This therapy targets IL-36. And when we did some biopsies of individuals who had palmoplantar psoriasis, we showed elevated levels of IL-36. Now, it's not approved for palmoplantar psoriasis. I'm not suggesting that it's approved for palmoplantar pustular psoriasis, but it's in study. Not in the United States, but it's in study. All right, IL-36 receptor blocker, and it's given the orphan drug status. I don't know, or designation. I don't know if you know how hard that is. The FDA doesn't give that golden ticket out very often. That's for serious diseases, and it shortens the time for the cost of development and the time to bringing it to market. So it's pretty special. Remember when AbbVie got that for HS? All right, 17% of infections at week one versus placebo at versus placebo, 6%. Two patients had DRESS, right? So drug rash with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. Those patients are not doing well. All right, so those are the patients, if I see them in clinic, we've got to, you know, all hands on deck, and we've got to start doing all kinds of workup. Okay, two patients with DRESS, and one of those also had a drug-induced hepatic injury. But again, GPP has high morbidity. You got to do something for these patients. You can't let them die on the vine. This represents a treatment gap for unmet need, and again, GPP is potentially life-threatening, and we're seeing rapid clearance in these patients. All right, as I alluded to before, for palmoplantar pustular psoriasis, they did some biopsies, which shows upregulated IL-36 signaling, and in study now, they're looking at an IV infusion every 4 weeks until week 12. Okay. Proof of concept on the horizon. These are things that you may probably haven't heard about, and you have to go to fdatrials.gov to find these. All right, topical gene-based gels, which may reduce the body from making tumor necrosis factor alpha, a topical, decreasing tumor necrosis factor alpha, a new JAK, a TYK2-JAK1 combination, which is brepocitinib. The oral trials were discontinued, but the topical trials are being continued. IL-2 inhibition, that's kind of something new. With psoriasis. Again, proof of concept. It's already being used. These IL-2 biologics are being used in kidney cancer, but they're also having an eye on the prize for psoriasis as well, too. Apremilast in pediatric patients, yes. That's in the future. So age 6 to 17. For moderate, that should be moderate to severe psoriasis. What about hypericin, synthetic hypericin? This is a molecule that, if given, it increases your sensitivity to receiving phototherapy. So for your patients who can't be on biologics for whatever, they can't afford a biologic, it's unfortunate that we punish Medicare-age patients who have saved up enough for their retirement. So sometimes you just have to use phototherapy, and this may be a way to get phototherapy to work better. All right, there is a phase 2 ROCK2 inhibitor, which is called the oral medication with biologic activity. For moderate to severe psoriasis, it's already approved for graft versus host disease and systemic sclerosis, and they're looking at, hey, what happens with these PASI scores? So a decrease in PASI score of about 66% after 1 month with an oral therapy. It decreases IL-17 and suppresses activity of regulatory T cells. Topical tropomyosin, again, that may decrease itching by decreasing the capsaicin influx of calcium. There is a combination therapy, yet another combination therapy with calcifitrol hydrocortisone, and this would be used for the face and skin folds. Abatacept, all right, we already talked about that being approved for rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis. Yeah, they're looking phase 1 to see if it works for psoriasis as well, too. Botox, really? In some studies, individuals who had, they were treating rhytids on the face, they noticed that their psoriasis on their face cleared up. And then conversely, some patients that were doing off-label for hyperhidrosis in the groin, their inverse psoriasis cleared up. That's interesting. Yeah, kind of expensive, but pretty interesting. Yeah, so the hypothesis is that Botox may decrease the neurogenic inflammation. All right, so that was my last slide. I've got 3 minutes. 3 minutes. All right, so questions. I know that was a whirlwind. I speak really fast. I'm from Texas.
Bueller? How do you screen for IBD?
Where am I?
Back here.
Yeah. I'm reading you.
IBD. Questions. Okay, great question. So I ask a patient, do you have excessive diarrhea, blood in your stool, weight loss without trying, diarrhea for prolonged periods of time? I'm not talking about the bad burrito that you ate 2 weeks ago. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about prolonged diarrhea. And if it's a child, are they missing their weight parameters, their weight and height parameters? Or if it's a young child, menarche may be delayed as well, too. So, yeah, that's how I just ask some questions. And, of course, if there's a family history of colon cancer, I always remind the patients that, okay, when was your mom had colon cancer at age 45? You should be getting a colonoscopy at 35. Right, so when was your last colonoscopy? And if you're 50 or above, or 45, excuse me, that number has decreased, 45, you should be getting a screening colonoscopy. So I always kind of remind my patients to get their age-appropriate cancer screenings. The older I get, the more I'm in tune to those kind of things. All right, so that's how I screen. A lot of creaking up here. Anything else? No? Well, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and listening to how quickly I speak. And I want to thank you, Andrew, if he's still here, Andrew, for coming up and being a volunteer for my psoriatic arthritis exam. All right, y'all have a great evening. Thanks for coming.
Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you back tomorrow morning.